This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black Left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, Black victims of police lawlessness keep piling up year after year, yet almost all the officers involved get off with no punishment whatsoever. We'll talk with an activist about impunity for killer cops. Nellie Bailey gets the real story on why record numbers of Puerto Ricans have been in the streets, and we'll have a report on the history of America as a white man's country.
But first, William C. Anderson is a prolific writer whose latest article in Truth Out is titled, Reparations is One Step in a Long Fight to End Racial Capitalism. Lots of Democratic presidential candidates have endorsed the principle of Black American reparations, but they all have different ideas on what shape reparations should take. Anderson says it's up to Black people to draft demands for reparations, and the subject is not open to debate. Black people are owed, period.
Absolutely. It's not anything that we should be negotiating or debating about. It's a demand. And there's a major difference between saying that somebody is owed something and that someone is deserving of something. So since we know that this is not actually a debate, we should be very straightforward about the fact that this is something that we're owed, and we know that we're owed. This is about acknowledging labor. This is about acknowledging exploitation and brutalization and a lot of egregious violence. So since it's been turned into a debate issue through the mainstreaming of the topic of reparations, you know, via the 2020 election, we're seeing people talk about it as if it's something that needs to be discussed by presidential candidates who are white and who have no connection to the Black community in a way that makes it into, you know, just another debate topic. And that's absolutely ridiculous. It's not something to be debated. We know that we're owed reparations. That's a fact.
Yes, two very tricky things seem to be happening in this process under the aegis of the Democratic presidential candidates. Number one, they seem to be throwing all of Black concerns into the reparations bag and tying it up neatly that way. And at the same time, they're putting it on a union negotiating kind of table. And so different candidates are coming in saying, well, I bid $100 million in reparations. Others throw in simple Democratic proposals like increasing aid to Black school districts or things of that nature, and they call that reparations.
Absolutely. It's funny because it's like, you know, I was just saying, we know that we're owed reparations, but the issue is for me, and I think of some other people, is largely that we're owed so much more than reparations, and that there isn't, you can't just put a number amount on all of the things that our people have been through. So when we're thinking about what we're owed and when we're making demands and taking a firm stance, it has to include the end of capitalism, period, because we cannot negotiate with the system that facilitated our ancestors' enslavement. We can't negotiate with this very system. That system's life has to be a part of what we're owed. Because the system that facilitated slavery obviously shouldn't exist anymore because it facilitated slavery. So if we're being real about this fight, then we have to be real about the fact that we're needing to get something much bigger than just a settlement. What we need is the end and the uprooting of all of the systems of violence that we're still dealing with day to day in the afterlife of slavery.
But of course, the capitalists and those that serve them their position would be that capitalism is non-negotiable.
And if that's the case, if capitalism is non-negotiable, then obviously we're negotiating with the wrong people, aren't we? Because what we're facing every day is the violence of the afterlife of slavery that is inflicted on us through capitalism. We're dealing with this through the prison system, through policing, and so many other extensions of anti-blackness in day-to-day life. So if we're going to actually be pushing for something to address the wrongs that have been done to us over centuries, then we really need to be thinking very largely about putting an end to and abolishing the systems of violence that we face day to day, because we can't take a reformist approach. Reformist approaches are what's gotten us to a Donald Trump presidency. If we think that we're going to reform our way out of the violence that we face, then we're in for a rude awakening. And we're going to be in this position of oppression for a very, very long time trying to take reformist approaches. We need to be thinking about abolition.
And abolition, meaning abolition of the capitalist system of which slavery was an integral part in the United States and globally.
There's no other way to go about it. It has to end.
You say that much of the language around this reparations conversation disturbingly relies on concepts like worthiness and innocence and goodness, as if that has anything to do with slavery and Jim Crow.
Yes, there's this kind of question that's floating in the air about do Black people deserve or not deserve reparations? And so when you start talking about what's deserved as opposed to what's owed, or even what would be liberating for us, there's some dangerous things that can happen there. And that's really because, you know, this concept of being deserving, it does feed into notions like innocence and guilt, which are inherently anti-Black in this society. We know that being undeserving and being guilty and bad are very racialized categories. And those are anti-Black categories that are used to reinforce our execution by police and by the state on a day-to-day basis. So when you look at the racism that's built into those categories, trying to utilize such a category as like being deserving to try to get reparations is actually counterproductive.
Yes, in fact, slavery was justified because Black folks were savages, and beating folks was justified because otherwise the slaves wouldn't work. And Jim Crow was justified because, well, Black folks didn't measure up to the standards of white people. And until they did, they needed to be separate. And mass Black incarceration is justified because Black people are criminals.
Exactly. And that criminalization of Blackness is something that white supremacy always essentially associates with Blackness. So it's like when, you know, a Black person is murdered by the police, there's always this question of what were they doing? Are they innocent or guilty? And that goes into, did they deserve to die? So when you start talking about if someone deserved to be killed or not, there is a connection there to other questions about what do Black people deserve or not deserve. What we know for certain is that the oppression that's inflicted on us in the United States of America is nothing that we deserve. And everything that comes with it and everything that's an extension of it is nothing that we deserve. So rather than having a conversation about what we do deserve instead, I think we should be having a conversation about what's owed and what we demand, because obviously we don't need to be negotiating with our oppressors about the terms of our oppression.
So the trick bag is to convert white crimes and oppressions against Black people into debating points, and then something that's about negotiation or conversation instead of a demand.
Absolutely, yeah. And I think that it really makes me think honestly about, rest in peace to Bruce Dixon, what he said about needing a viable political project when he was talking about reparations and having something that is actually going to have a life, have something that exists past just being reactionary and not having a real plan in place for what our future is going to look like. We're up against some pretty devastating things right now when you take the political climate into consideration, when you take the actual physical climate and nature and climate crises that are happening around the world into consideration. We're up against some pretty devastating things. So if we're leading movements, we need to have a viable political project in line for sure.
Well, some of us have suggested that the organization of a great Black political debate around reparations could be important in formulating the most broad-based demands. That is, Black folks shouldn't be debating with white folks about reparations because the debt is clearly owed. But certainly there's the need for debate about the nature of the demands among Black people.
Absolutely. We don't need to be having discussions with people who oppress us on a day-to-day basis about what we do and don't need. I think that there is a lot of potential in a larger Black discussion about this topic. But also, I do think that, as we know, that there have been elements that have risen in this conversation that are feeding into nationalism and colonial violence and kind of defining Blackness through borders. And I think that that's a very dangerous thing that's kind of crept into the reparations conversation that we have to be very wary about as well. So if we are having a larger conversation, it needs to be sincere and genuine, and it doesn't need to have any of the elements of white supremacy and anti-Blackness that are oppressing us. We need to be trying to eliminate those things from our community and not embracing them to divide ourselves or create some sort of hierarchy amongst ourselves around our Blackness.
You're, of course, talking about ADOS, which has encouraged some of the most chauvinistic aspects of Black politics. But also, I think, the reparations issue, as it has been previously framed, which depends fundamentally on legal questions, itself locks folks into a Black Americans-only kind of position.
Yeah, you know, there's a few things there to think about. And I don't actually know a lot about ADOS. I am aware of them, but I don't know a lot about them aside from some of their positions that I've read online. And what I've seen is a lot of things that I don't agree with. And because of that, I've kind of steered clear of a lot of the elements and some of the conversations that they're having. But what I will say is the things that I did see that I disagreed with coming from them are things that have existed prior to their foundation. Those are things that we've been dealing with in our community for a long time. And it's unfortunate to see a lot of the divisiveness that's coming from there. And so going forward, I think that we have to really be sincere and really be real about rejecting this Black American exceptionalism that we see that's becoming much more pervasive than it should be. It's really kind of gross to see some folks think that being from the United States gives us a exceptionalism that as Black people that we should embrace. That's not anything that we should ever embrace. It's something that we should be wholeheartedly rejecting.
And in fact, many proponents of Black American reparations link it intrinsically to global reparations for all of the peoples, especially Africans, but all of the peoples that have been enslaved, oppressed, and colonized by Western Europe and then the United States.
Our struggles are not isolated. Our struggles are connected. And I've written before about how solidarity abolishes borders. And when you have an understanding of struggles that goes beyond borders, it can help break them down. Because this affirmation of the state, this embracing of nationalism and borders, is exactly the antithesis of what we need to be doing when it comes to working to get rid of these violent structures that are helping maintain everything that we're supposed to be fighting against. So when we start to understand history and understand the depth of Blackness and Black people, then it does us a service to our struggle, because this is going to take a great coalition to do some of the things that we need to accomplish and achieve. And that goes beyond just one group of us. We need to be understanding the struggles of African people, Black people all over the world. And so that's just facts. And if we are unaware and ignorant about the struggles of people who have a lot in common with us and who share histories with us and movements and fights with us, then we're doing ourselves a disservice.
That was author William C. Anderson.
Why Accountability New York is determined to make killer cops face the consequences of their crimes. Shannon Jones is an activist in Why Accountability. She and others last week marked a host of unpunished deaths at the hands of police, including Sandra Bland in Texas 4 years ago and Eric Garner 5 years ago in Staten Island, New York. Neither of the cops involved was indicted. Jones talks about impunity and killer cops.
Well, what I will say about his status, which is critically important when we talk about impunity, his status, whether he's employed by a slave patrolling agency or not, right? His status is, this country has a social contract with him. There's a social contract that exists. This extends to slave patrollers, police, terrorists, child molesters, abusers, sex traffickers, capitalists, white collar criminals, etc. These are social contracts that exist between the United States and the white community, to where folks will be punished as little as possible or zero in order to maintain and harness power and control over people of color in this country. And this is where we need to take a look and push back on. That's evident in 1033 program legislation. That is evident in police being indemnified. That is exhibited in state agencies already budgeting, particularly in the case of New York, hundreds of millions of dollars in the budget to account for brutality, right? All of those things are the social contract that the United States government has with white America. So whether he's on the force, off the force, sitting at home, on disability, moved to another agency, his social contract with America remains intact. Look at the police that killed Tamir Rice. Just move to a different police department. You are exercising your monopoly money, so to speak, and moving your hotel from one block to another. He's protected under that social contract. He's working under that social contract. He'll never be fired under that social contract.
Speaking of that social contract, somebody that at least as yet has not had to move their monopoly hotel anywhere is one Daniel Pantaleo, currently facing some so-called disciplinary trial. Within a week of Sandra Bland's action, yourself, Why Accountability, a number of other organizations throughout the city participated in actions for Eric Garner, honoring 5 years since his murder at the hands of Daniel Pantaleo. And from what I hear, y'all stepped through to his place of residence. What can you tell us about that action?
Okay, well, let me break that down. What I will speak on first is the disciplinary process in of itself. Well, before I do that, let's get to the criminal aspect of what happened to Eric Garner. And I'll even double back and make sure we raise the name of Ramsey Ortem. Because if we recall, there were two other men murdered on Staten Island, one of which was choked out by the police also, which we never talk about. So if Ramsey Ortem had not filmed it and agreed for that footage to be broadcast worldwide, Eric Garner would have just been another choked out black man on the island that no one would have known about. So Ramsey Ortem is the only person at this point that is experiencing any suffering from being on the scene at Eric Garner's murder. Not any of the police officers. Daniel Pantaleo, D'Amico, Kizzy Adonis, who is also up for ATU trial soon, and any of the other, up to this point, unnamed uniform officers that was at the scene. That is critical. Drawing parallel to Ramali Graham, drawing parallel to Sahi Vassal, where families and the public at large are waiting weeks, months, years, or never to even know the names of the people that had a hand in the murder of their loved one. That is completely out of order. So then the next piece is no indictment on criminal charges, which is ridiculous because let's be real. No one up to this point can point to me a penal code for selling a loose cigarette, which Eric Garner was not doing. But the NYPD and politicians engaged in propagating a false narrative that the arrest was for selling loosies, which it doesn't exist in the penal code. So whatever we try to propagate as the pretense for stepping to him to begin with is completely false. So a criminal act was committed by just stepping to him and putting your hands on him. So we fell for the okie doke as far as not latching on to the appropriate narrative 5 years ago. Because for the past 5 years, we've been talking about, was it a chokehold? Was it a band chokehold? Was it a seatbelt maneuver? Does this guy have old brutality lawsuits? No, that's step two. Step one is there's no such crime in the penal code. Police officers have no authority over that. The regulation in New York City regarding tobacco sales applies to businesses, not individuals. See? So that's another thing that black people, we have to do in order to push our liberation. We have to become in tune with what the law is as well to make sure the correct narrative is set. And when we say the whole damn system is guilty, no legal aid pushed the appropriate narrative. No legal organization pushed the appropriate narrative. No nonprofit organization that claims to stand alongside families that have lawyers at their payroll pushed the proper narrative. Nothing. Everyone stood around about a chokehold and previous brutality complaint. But that is not, it was not the issue. That's my opinion on that. So then moving forward, since there's no criminal charges related to Eric Garner's murder by police, then we're moving into this internal disciplinary. So the CCRB conducted an investigation and determined that this officer should be on charges. That also is a dog and pony show, because as union municipal employees, the only person that can fire you is management after arbitration. So all this process is for a recommendation to the police commissioner, Jimmy O'Neill. Waste of time. I was present, as a matter of fact, for day 6 of the trial, June 5th, and saw defense testimony. The judge allowed Daniel Pantaleo to submit his IAB statement or portions of it instead of taking the stand. He did not take the stand in his own defense. CCRB had the opportunity at that point to call Daniel Pantaleo as a hostile witness and chose not to. The family sitting right there the mother of his youngest child, Jewel Miller, and other family members didn't even hear that man speak one word. How disrespectful is that to the entire planet? The bottom line is Daniel Pantaleo should have been fired July 18, 2014 anyway. So then what we have here is a man that has stood around and collected payroll for 5 more years. Is his pension now vested? Is that the reason why this process went on so long? I spoke about the social contract that the U.S. government has with white America. And that is a prime example. He's been paid anywhere between $100,000 to $130,000 a year while on desk duty with overtime and et cetera. That helping him pay off his mortgage and vest his pension. This is the social contract for which we are speaking of. 5 years later, picking up the address to his home, we took it to his house. 5 years overdue, because really the public should have been at his door July 19th, 2014. But the social contract provided that his location be protected. How many times over the past 5 years have journalists taken pictures of him, taking out his garbage, leaving his home, getting in his car? But the public, who really at the end of the day, he's really answerable to, that information didn't get to the general public. These so-called inside game Negroes and these so-called good cops. Nobody said, look, this guy's a murderer. This is where he lives. 5 years, that's the social contract. So on July 17th, the legacy that Eric Garner left behind, which is the organization, an organized body from Jewel Miller, the mother of his youngest child, and my organization, Y Accountability NYC, shut it down. Many, many organizations. It was about maybe 100 people. We went to the South Shore, Staten Island, followed by cops on our way there, surrounded by cops walking through that Oakwood Heights neighborhood. He lives on 28 in Homira, and we went to his home, completely blocked off by police and heavy artillery equipment. 1033 program. See, all of these dots connect. All of these dots connect. And it's a matter of, what are people going to do? Oh, just, oh, 5 years later, you know, now you're worn out or you're tired or you don't want to hear about it anymore. It's time to go back to, you know, buying Gucci and hanging out or doing whatever, or pretending that it doesn't apply to you. And that's my message for the Black community. There are too few African people in this country sustaining their indignation to police brutality and terror in this country. Facebook, keyboard thugging does not cut it. As a matter of fact, white supremacy uses what we write across those platforms to data mine, weaponize it against us, commodify it, and exploit us. So, when this next level nonsense hits the fan by the end of the month, August 30th or 31st, when we'll know the CCRB's verdict, what you gonna do? Debate it on Facebook?
And just to clarify, 3 of the 13 members of the CCRB are chosen by the very same NYPD commissioner. So one of the points that you brought out is the question of naming and definition. If you Google Eric Garner right now, it will say, quote, cause of death, asthma attack caused by chokehold, etc., unquote. What does that say to you as regards this question of how the narrative has shifted and who controls it? What does something like that tell you about how organizing needs to occur moving forward with regard to these patrollers?
The big thing that organizing needs to do is to conduct your own investigation, right? So from July 18th, when everybody saw the video, hey, he was billed by mainstream outlets as the quote-unquote Lucy Man, which was a false narrative. The mainstream media did not discuss the other harassment complaints that Eric Garner had against the police department. You still don't hear about that comprehensively in media outlets. Radical organizations must conduct their own investigations, whether that be you look into disciplinary records. We know that 50A has made that difficult, but hey, dig. Even if you have to knock on doors, interview people, go to the scene, make your own recordings, and set your own information, do your own fact-finding with regard to what occurred and what it is that the general public needs to know and act on and contextualize it appropriately. These nonprofits that pride themselves on standing with families will always miscontextualize or dig into the false narrative in order to maintain white supremacy, because that's where their money comes from. That's where their money comes from. I tell any person, if you've been victimized by police brutality, stay away from nonprofits, stay away from National Action Network, stay away from it. And that's the other piece I want to bring about, is mainstream media outlets conjoin, so to speak, the resistance action that occurred. And I said action singularly because there was only one resistance action that was unpermitted, which took place on Victory and Bay Street in Staten Island on the 17th. The other nonsense at Foley Square, there was no contextual, political, or historical significance of holding any action on Foley Square. For what? Police did not kill Eric Garner in Foley Square. What are you doing over there? Then you're doing it at 5 o'clock when government offices are closed. So that's not radical tradition. But then the following day, then there's this dog and pony show at Gracie Mansion. It's also important in the radical tradition to have a long memory. Why Accountability prides itself as an organization of having a long memory. December 3rd, anniversary of the non-indictment in 2015, same court jesters did Gracie Mansion with arrests and all of this nonsense. All of that is to galvanize the public away from the people, places, and issues that matter around this police terrorism. How could a politician that continues to fund the NYPD and authorize the addition of 1,300 cops in fiscal year 16 stand next to a family around police brutality? That's stupid. Black people got to get in tune on this stuff.
That was Shannon Jones of Why Accountability, New York.
Record-breaking crowds of Puerto Ricans have been demanding the resignation of that island colony's governor, Ricardo Rosello. To explain why Puerto Ricans are protesting, we spoke with activist Danny Vila, labor coordinator of C.C. Pecari Culture and Labor Center in Queens, New York. He says Puerto Ricans have a multitude of grievances, but what set it off was a chat thread.
They had this very, very vile, venomous chat going on in a supposedly confidential chat in an application called Telegram. And Telegram, supposedly, after they speak and exchange messages, supposedly the messages disappear. But lo and behold, a few days ago, somebody revealed anonymously 889 pages of these chats, or of this chat, which goes back several years during the administration of Governor Ricardo Rosello, who incidentally happens to be the son of a former governor 20 years ago, more or less, whose name is Pedro Rosello, and whose administration was probably the most corrupt administration in Puerto Rico history up until this one. And that government also was suffered many arrests. Federal government, the U.S. government went in there and arrested many people, and many others were prosecuted by the local Puerto Rican authorities for corruption. Practically everybody in his government except the governor, Pedro Rosello, and it is the same situation happening with this present governor. As soon as that chat came out, in which he calls, and I'm not going to use the vulgar words that he used, to describe Mark Viverito, the former Puerto Rican councilwoman here in New York, the mayor, female, Yulín Cruz, the mayor of San Juan, Puerto Rico, for example, and many other women. They used language, vulgar language, calling them whores, prostitutes, and things of that nature. They made many references which were homophobic against homosexuals, against lesbian women. They even, incredibly, this has brought tears to many, many people's eyes, and this is why people are so indignant. They even made jokes and puns about the people who were victims of two hurricanes. You mentioned one hurricane, correct, Hurricane Maria, but there had been one hurricane about 2 or 3 weeks before called Hurricane Irma, which also struck Puerto Rico. And so they even made, incredibly, comments making fun of the fact that these people had died and where their bodies were being stored. So in any case, immediately, right off the bat, it was the chat which caused the explosion. But of course, there are many, many, many other elements going back many decades, and especially in this government. And I could give you some examples in a little while.
But in the same week that those text messages were released to the public, 8 members of the governor's staff were arrested for corruption, money laundering. So it seemed to have been a cumulative effect of people being completely indignant and wanting a change.
Well, what happened, though, is a little bit before that, about a month before that, this person who was the secretary, what they were called, el secretario de Hacienda, which is sort of like in the U.S., the secretary of the treasury or the person in charge of the general finances of the country, the right-hand man picked by Governor Ricardo Rosselló, Raúl Maldonado, resigned. He resigned about a month before, and he said that the finances of Puerto Rico were being controlled by criminal mafia elements within the Department of Finances and the government. Immediately after he went to the press, he did not say this to Ricardo Rosselló, he went to the media because he was afraid for his own personal security. The governor, instead of praising him for denouncing corruption, fired him and reprimanded him. Actually, he had resigned, but then the governor reprimanded him and told him that that was inappropriate behavior, that he should have gone to the governor first. Obviously, he did not go to the governor first because he was afraid for his own security. It turns out that this person, Raúl Maldonado, the director of finances, was also a member of the 12-men chat on Telegram, this personal chat that the governor made all these rude comments and so on and so forth. And so people believe that it was this person who revealed, or his son, who is at very, very, and incidentally, they're all members of the same very reactionary pro-statehood party.
And the name of that party?
It's called the New Progressive Party, Partido Nuevo Progresista, New Progressive Party. It is neither new and it is not progressive, but that's the way in Puerto Rico. All the parties, interesting, the other one is the Popular Democratic Party, and it is not popular and it's not democratic, but they assume names which sound very populist and almost socialist or revolutionary. It's interesting, the logic in Puerto Rico. In any case, what happened is that apparently when Raúl Maldonado resigned, he said he was going immediately to the federal government. Immediately. So it's probable that the federal government was already making investigations. In any case, with the denunciations of former person in charge of finances to the federal government, it is possible that that accelerated the arrests, which you mentioned. And incidentally, Governor Rosselló was urged by Tomás Rivera Chats, who was also a member of his New Progressive Pro-Statehood Party, to fire everybody who was in the chat from the government. So he fired 11 people from his government, and then everybody in Puerto Rico says, but wait a minute, you fired everybody. You were the main culprit here. Why don't you resign? And that's where the thing exploded, and people said, okay, so then you have to resign also.
Governor Rosselló has declared that he is not going to resign, which prompted the leader of the Puerto Rican House of Representatives, Melendez, to create an impeachment committee. They're looking at the corruption charges, whether or not there are grounds for criminal prosecution, as well as the impeachment process itself. What form will it take, and what would replace the governorship?
Yes, but this is just a show. This is a little show that they're putting on for the public. His name is Johnny Mendez, and he's also pro-statehood, and he's also of the governor's party. And he has been very supportive of the governor, just like the president of the Puerto Rican Senate, Tomás Rivera Schatz, also president, also a member of his New Progressive Party. So they are both in agreement. That is, the president of the Senate in Puerto Rico and the president of the House of Representatives, who is Johnny Mendez, that an investigation to see the legal possibilities of proceeding with an impeachment. But it ain't going to go that far, because right now, even Jennifer Gonzalez, who is the Puerto Rican resident commissioner in Washington, D.C., also pro-statehood and of the same party, she is now calling for his resignation. Even the Association of Police Officers, sort of like a union of police officers in Puerto Rico, are demanding his resignation. Bishops and the Catholic community have come out demanding his resignation. All sorts of business organizations, like chamber, sort of like in the U.S. you have the Chamber of Commerce, where in Puerto Rico you have four or five of these organizations, and three of them have already come out demanding that he resign. The Federation of Mayors, which is pro-statehood, all the pro-statehood mayors of Puerto Rico, they're in an organization. They have come out asking him to resign. So what Johnny Mendez is doing is really a pro forma sort of stuff, but that would take months. And Puerto Rico is not going to tolerate this criminal to be in office for months. So, but in any case, my opinion is that this will probably be settled within the next week. He is going to have to resign.
Mm-hmm. Now, there are many different sectors in the streets protesting and calling for the governor's resignation. They cover all sectors, private and civil society. Can you talk about these forces, in particular the labor forces and the independence movement forces?
Okay, thank you for that question. But I would like to quickly add that, again, like I said, all the scandal which has arisen as a result of the information coming out of that chat in the application called Telegram, this is just the sort of like the explosion. There are other reasons why the country is going ballistic against him. Since Obama was in the presidency, about in his third year of his second term, he signed a bill called PROMESA. PROMESA is a law which created an eight-person junta. It's called the Puerto Rico Oversight, Management, and Economic Stability Act. But it's called PROMESA because in Spanish, PROMESA means promise. And there's how phony they get and corny they can get. But in any case, that law created an eight-person dictatorship, which literally has more power than the Puerto Rican Senate, than the House, than the governor, and even more power than the Puerto Rican courts. And this eight-person junta, which is called a junta in Puerto Rico, but this junta, which also to us in the United States sounds like a military junta, is definitely dictatorial, and they have the power to override anything decided. So this eight-person dictatorial junta is working on behalf of Wall Street. Their mission is to use, as John Perkins pointed out in his book, I was a hitman for the IMF and the World Bank, something along those lines, but he was a hitman for them. And in that book, he points out how he would get Ecuador, Mexico, Argentina, Brazil. These countries would then be forced to give Wall Street and the private sector their public properties. For example, telephone companies, the hospitals, education, everything will be... Okay, so this is the same scenario which is being carried out in Puerto Rico right now. What they're doing is they're taking over and they're trying to privatize the public energy administration.
Yes.
The water resources, education. The former head of education, who was arrested last week by the federal government, Kellerer, Julia Kellerer, well, she was in the process of destroying. She closed sort of like 40% of the public schools in Puerto Rico because she wants to push private education. So this board, basically what it's doing is privatizing the huge public sector in Puerto Rico and giving it to Wall Street. So that has created a huge amount of... I have, for example, five nephews and nieces. They're all in the United States. They used to live in Puerto Rico, and now with the crisis, they're all college educated. They're all working here. They all got jobs in less than a week over here. And likewise, about 1 million, almost 1 million Puerto Ricans over the last 8 years have come to the United States or gone to other countries because of the serious crisis created by this board. But the problems go beyond that even. It's a colonial problem. It's a problem of capitalism. And these are the elements which, of course, the corporate press will not talk about. In Puerto Rico, incredibly, they do. Here in the United States, they ignore this and they just talk about the chat. The chat is very important because it demonstrates how corrupt and cynical and criminal-minded these people in government in Puerto Rico are. And that's why people are they've had it. But there's a greater problem, and it's the fact that Puerto Rico has been a colony of the United States since 1898. It was invaded in 1898 when the United States invaded Cuba, Guam, and the Philippines. And Puerto Rico, Nellie Bailey, believe it or not, in 1898, Puerto Rico was self-sufficient. In fact, Puerto Rico exported agricultural products to Europe, to Spain, and other countries. And it was a period, remember, when other countries in Latin America, pretty much all of them had gained their independence. And so Puerto Rico already had achieved a charter of autonomy. So Puerto Rico was almost independent, and it was ripe for the picking for U.S. imperialism.
So we've talked about the different sectors that are involved. Let's talk about the different sectors in terms of numbers and the record number of protesters who have turned out. For example, in Old San Juan, it was an estimated crowd of 500,000 more people in a demonstration that has ever been seen on the island. But talk about the other municipalities and townships throughout Puerto Rico that has come out demanding the resignation of the governor and the spillover of that here in this country. For example, a more recent demonstration here in the States that surprised you. It was in the heart of the heartland. It was in the Midwest. Can you talk about that?
It surprised me, and it surprised everybody here and everybody in Puerto Rico, because even the people that were taking part in these huge demonstrations have taken part, also saying that they feel surprised that so many other people feel the same sense of being offended and as
outrage.
Outraged that this government has to go. It's something that was simmering, that was like subliminal, underground. People felt it, but people were afraid or didn't have the time or for whatever reason didn't feel inspired or motivated enough to express it. And now, like you say, even the corporate press, because this is the major corporate newspaper of Puerto Rico is called El Nuevo Día, The New Day. And that paper had on its front page that 500,000 people came out last Wednesday to protest against the government. So the demonstrations have not only been focused in San Juan, which is the tradition for almost 100 years. This week, there have been huge demonstrations in Ponce, which is the southern coast of Puerto Rico, also in Mayagüez, also in Sarremán, which are on the west. And in fact, as we are speaking, there was a march going to Gurabo. Gurabo is like in the middle, like almost in the heart, but a little bit to the east of Puerto Rico. Caguas, between San Juan and Caguas, there's a town called Gurabo, a small town of about 25,000 people. And I've been there many, many, many times. And there's a march going to Gurabo right now. But it's not only in Puerto Rico. I was shocked last night at 4 a.m. when I was reading that and seeing a video on Facebook of a demonstration going on, of all places, in Salt Lake City, Utah. Hundreds of Puerto Ricans marching very militantly against this corruption in Puerto Rico. And there have also been demonstrations in California. There have been demonstrations in Florida, in Kissimmee, in Orlando, Florida, and other places in Florida where there are Puerto Rican communities. And, of course, here in New York, thousands have come out. There have been a couple of activities at Union Square Park, which have just been huge. Also, in New York City, of course, it's a little bit different because you have a lot of African-American and white European-American activists, people, remember, you know, people, it's not just a Puerto Rican thing here in New York City. You may have on last Wednesday, I believe it was, or Tuesday, there were about 500, 600 people at Union Square, but about half of them were non-Puerto Rican and very much in solidarity. So this is something which has gone wherever there's a Puerto Rican community right now in the hemisphere. It seems that there are demonstrations going on demanding not only the resignation of the government, because the major demonstration, a march of tens of thousands of people led by labor, 40 labor organizations came together with all the other political independentistas, pro-independence organizations. But the main sign, the main banner, was saying, Rosselló, leave and take the fiscal control board with you. So that's where the fight is going, apparently.
Right. Let's delve into those other demands. Obviously, the resignation of the governor, Rosselló. But what are the other demands, and what can these demands lead to in terms of the independence movement?
Right now, the main demand, everybody's trying to be unified and keep unity. So intelligently, in my opinion, the pro-independent forces and the socialist forces and revolutionary organizations, which are very small in Puerto Rico, but which are the ones which are really leading and organizing these activities. They're the ones. It's not being organized by pro-statehooders. It's not being organized by people that favor the present colonial status of free associated state. It's not being organized by Martians. It's being organized by pro-independence and pro-socialist revolutionary people. But they understand that the outrage right now is against the abuses of this governor, so it's focused on that. The main danger, as many of us see it, is that something similar to what happened when Nixon was president in the United States, or also recently in Peru, where the president of Peru, Kuczynski, there were millions of people there also for several weeks demanding that Kuczynski resign because of scandalous, same thing, corruption in his government, and he resigned. But who took over? His vice president, Vizcarra. Vizcarra is just the same, except that he's much more sophisticated. So in Puerto Rico, we might have a situation as when Nixon resigned, so he left Ford in charge. But of course, Ford was his buddy and had promised not to take him to jail. So we could have a very similar situation in Puerto Rico right now, where the Secretary of Justice is a corrupt flunky named by the governor of Puerto Rico. And she has a whole bunch of accusations, which I'm not going to go into, about her own dubious dealings, financial dealings. She would be the person pretty much taking over right now, being that there is not a Secretary of State. You see, because the problem is that according to the Constitution of Puerto Rico, the Secretary of State would be the person who would relieve the governor. But the governor fired his whole entire cabinet, with the exception of the Secretary of Justice. And so right now, the problem is that if the governor does leave and the Secretary of Justice takes over, or whoever takes over, we'll be left with a situation where these same corrupt criminal elements will remain in power. So what the more progressive, more socially, and people who have more of a political vision are trying to do in Puerto Rico right now is to try to have possibly one of two things. A government of national salvation takeover. That is, a government made up of all the political currents, ideological in Puerto Rico, pro-statehood, pro-free associated state, the ones that want some type of sovereignty for Puerto Rico but not independence, those of us that want independence, and those of us that want a revolutionary workers' state. Everybody will be part of that government, and for X amount of years would try to create the conditions for a truly democratic election. That's one possibility. The other possibility, being pushed by some people also of progressive mind, is to have a constitutional convention. The constitutional convention is something which in Puerto Rico has been considered for about 70 years as a way of ending the colonial status. That is, we could have a united assembly of all the political factors, elements, organizations in Puerto Rico coming together with the idea of creating a new constitution, which would then be more representative and done and made and written by Puerto Ricans rather than this U.S.-imposed constitution, that will be a way of decolonizing Puerto Rico. So we have those two possible possibilities, that is, real possibilities. Of course, there's always the alternative of a revolutionary taking over of power, but I don't see that on the agenda at this point, although, of course, who knows what is in the future.
That was Danny Vila speaking from New York City. Just when you think that Donald Trump had reached the limits of racism in the Oval Office, he sets new lows. Glenn Ford files this report.
Donald Trump has turned up the white supremacist heat in hopes of winning a second term in office. The man knows his people, having won the majority of white voters of both sexes with his racist rants the last time around. Now he's whipping up the crowds with calls for the four young Democratic congresswomen, known as the Squad, to go back where they came from. Of course, only Minnesota Congresswoman Ilhan Omar was born somewhere else. But Trump's fans know exactly what he means, that the United States is a white man's country, and he's the president who's going to keep it that way. Trump's nonstop racist theatrics are designed to show him holding back the tide of immigration that the U.S. Census Bureau predicts will make whites a minority by the year 2045. Trump's insistence that this is a white man's country puts him in the mainstream, not only of contemporary white opinion, but of American history. The Founding Fathers' mission was to carve out a white man's nation, which they hoped would become a white man's empire, once the Native Americans were removed or exterminated. Except among a small minority of whites, there was never any question of allowing full citizenship rights to blacks. The U.S. Supreme Court spelled it out quite clearly in its 1857 Dred Scott decision, ruling that blacks have no rights in this country that a white man is bound to respect. Abraham Lincoln, up to the time that he became president, could not conceive of any future for a free black population in America. In 1861, the first year of the Civil War, Lincoln asked Congress to appropriate funds to ship runaway slaves out of the country. The great emancipator, just like most of the other white folks, considered the United States to be a white man's country. The westward expansion of the United States was fulfillment of Thomas Jefferson's dream of a white man's empire. Teddy Roosevelt, that other face on Mount Rushmore, was a flaming white nationalist racist who celebrated the extinction of Native Americans as inevitable. Roosevelt painted the U.S. naval fleet white and sailed it around the world to show that the American white empire was an equal of the European white empires. Teddy's cousin, President Franklin Roosevelt, called the citizens of Haiti little more than savages. I must mention here that both Roosevelts were considered progressives. So, in the United States, one can be a racist and an imperialist and still be thought of as a progressive. By the end of World War II, Thomas Jefferson's white man's empire had gone fully global, straddling the world and claiming rights and privileges above all other nations. Conservatives and liberals, Republicans and Democrats, all spoke the same language of American exceptionalism, as if the whole planet was their plantation. Barack Obama, the first black overseer, proclaimed the doctrine of responsibility to protect, which gives the U.S. the right to invade other countries at will. Obama signed the executive order that paved the way for Donald Trump's murderous sanctions against Venezuela in order to overthrow a government that is supported by that country's black, brown, and indigenous population. Most so-called progressives in Congress have no problem with Donald Trump's Venezuelan policies. They're okay with an American exceptionalism that resembles a modern-day Dred Scott decision by which the darker peoples of the world have no rights that the United States is bound to respect. I'm Glenn Ford, Black Agenda Report. You've been listening to the Black Agenda Report on the Progressive Radio Network. Information for liberation.